kiss her again. Renata felt her cheeks grow redder.
"Are you going to sit?"
Nikolai asked.
"What? Oh, yes, thank you."
She sat on the chair, apron still on, hands balled up in the ties because she didn't know what to do with them, either the ties or her hands. Nikolai exhaled audibly as he lowered himself into one of the chairs opposite her. He closed his eyes and rubbed the back of his neck. His mouth turned downward in a frown. Renata gasped in surprise as she realized what she was seeing. His mouth. His actual mouth. Nikolai wasn't a shadow anymore. Nikolai opened his eyes again and raised his brows.
"Why are you staring?"
Renata blinked.
"Because I can see you."
"Ah, right. My mother's dead. I took most of her energy before she passed, which finally gave me enough power that I'm able to cast a facade that looks like a facsimile of myself.
I..."
There was too much in those few sentences to know which to respond to first. Renata shook her head to sort them out.
"Your mother died?"
she decided to ask.
"Yes. She was arrested for murdering the Tsar and sentenced to death. But I took care of it before she was hanged."
Renata's mouth hung open. Nikolai took a sip of his tea.
"No need to be alarmed. She asked me to kill her out of mercy." I see,"
Renata said, although she didn't see at all. Why was he so casual about this? Her brain scrambled to keep up with Nikolai's reasoning, but it couldn't seem to do it. She defaulted to her most common sentiment instead.
"Are you all right?"
He let out a short bark of a laugh.
"She wasn't much of a mother, and I'm not sure she was entirely human either. It's no great loss that she's dead."
Renata recoiled from the table. This boy before her looked like Nikolai, but he wasn't the one she knew and loved. That Nikolai was so vulnerable to emotion, it actually tortured him. But this Nikolai...
"You said you've cast the facade,"
Renata said carefully.
"Does that mean you're still a shadow underneath it?"
Nikolai smiled, but in a way Renata didn't recognize. It was too cunning, and it didn't invoke the dimple in his cheek like Nikolai's real smile would. He released his facade and immediately turned to shadow again, although his edges were clearly defined, not blurred now. Renata's hands stilled in her lap, even more knotted in the apron strings than before.
"You said before that my being a shadow didn't scare you. Have you changed your mind?"
"No."
"Good."
He recast his facade and smiled again. Yes, there was definitely something very wrong with this Nikolai, for the one who had been Renata's dearest friend would have known she was lying.
"Galina's dead too,"
he said, without any hint of mourning.
"It turns out she left the house to me, probably because there was no one else to leave it to. So I came tonight to offer you a job, if you'll take it."
"At the house?"
"Yes, your old job,"
Nikolai said.
"Say you'll come."
The apron strings were wrapped so tightly around Renata's hands that they cut vicious white lines into her skin.
"Please,"
he said, but he was not smiling anymore. Renata nodded.
"Yes, of course. I knew I could count on you."
He drained the rest of the tea from his cup and rose, leaving the pain au raisin untouched. Before Renata could even get to her feet, he had his greatcoat and hat on. They were both pitch black. In fact, everything he wore was black, she noticed. There was no splash of colorful lining inside his coat, or even a fanciful handkerchief. Unique touches Nikolai used to pride himself on.
"I'll see you at the house, then."
He didn't even say goodbye as he unlocked the bakery door and let himself out onto the snowy street. Renata stared after him, but once he was out of sight, she turned back to the table to clear the plate on which she'd brought the pain au raisin and the cup and saucer for Nikolai's tea. His cup was nearly, but not quite, drained. He never drank the last drops around her, even though she'd long ago promised she wouldn't read his leaves without explicit permission. As Nikolai had left them, The leaf suggested death was once again near. But as she stood over his cup, something inside her sparked. She wasn't touching the tray or the table, yet his tea leaves shifted.
What? Did that really happen?
Renata squinted at the pointed black leaves. One of them had turned a little in the cup.
I did that,
she whispered. The remnants of the energy Aijana had given her danced a jig in Renata's veins. If it had been a true prophecy, if Nikolai's cup had been entirely drained, these leaves would have meant that death was a little delayed. And perhaps even more important, if Renata could influence how the tea leaves fell inside their cups, did that mean that fates could be changed? Chapter 51 Nikolai looked over his room at the black moth one more time.
I'm certainly not leaving this cesspool with the improvements I conjured.
He whipped his hand in front of him, as if swiping away the furniture. And indeed, the beds and horsehair mattresses and porcelain washbasin he'd created vanished. He snapped, and the old louse-ridden, chipped and stained furniture reappeared. He wrinkled his nose at the once again filthy space. There was nothing at the Black Moth that he needed to take with him, not even memories. He'd had a mother, briefly, and that had turned out to be quite enough. Besides, she'd left her legacy with him, in the form of the unforgiving darkness coursing through his veins.
Au revoir,
Nikolai said as he spun and left the room.
Et bon débarras.
And good riddance. He strode through the streets of the city, to a Katerinsky canal. It was much faster crossing St. Petersburg, now that Nikolai could cast a shroud to look like a normal person, and didn't have to slink in the shadows.
Finally, something's going right.
He smirked to himself, as he passed by one of the many granite posts along the canal's embankment. The post smirked back.
Deuces!
Nikolai staggered a step and looked at the post again. It was indeed smirking. And it was no longer a post, but instead a gargoyle, and a grotesque one at that, with a wart-ridden, troll-like face, seven gnarled horns curling out of its head, and blank eyeballs that rattled and rolled in their sockets.
Did I jest?
But surely not. Nikolai hadn't even thought to create the gargoyle, let alone cast an actual charm. And yet, it was not the sort of thing Vika would conjure. It was as if the gargoyle were a tangible manifestation of how Nikolai actually felt inside, just like his shroud was a physical version of how he, still a shadow really, felt he ought to look.
I don't know if it's a good thing I can now use magic without having to think about it, or if it's bad that it's not entirely under my control.
But then Nikolai thought of what this meant in terms of power. The magic prickling at his fingertips was colder and stronger than ever. And his eyes twinkled, although not brightly like stars, rather like black holes, swallowing light into their depths. At the mere hint of Nikolai's delight, all the posts along the rivers and canals in the city transformed themselves into gargoyles, with vacant eyes that watched and followed every movement of passers-by, and the renewed energy inside Nikolai roiled gleefully at the mayhem this new enchantment would cause. He marched up to the Zakrebsky house with a dark spring in his step and charmed open the door. He walked into the foyer and had only a few seconds to take in the familiar setting, the Persian rugs, the heirloom grandfather clock, the crystal chandelier, and the staircase that curved up behind it, before Vadim, the footman, ran out to greet him. Or perhaps not to greet him, seeing as Vadim wasn't dressed in uniform, but wore a plain tunic and trousers, and a dry spittle crusted on his face. He must have been recovering from the food at the Nivar Fete, like most everyone else. His eyes bulged, and he came to an abrupt halt when he saw it was Nikolai in the foyer.
Master Karimov,
he said, falling immediately into a bow.
I mean, Grand Prince, your Imperial Highness. We were not expecting you.
Nikolai motioned with his hand for Vadim to rise.
Is it really you?
Vadim asked.
Yes.
Surprised.
There was a rumor that you were alive, but no one had seen you, so most dismissed it.
And what did you believe? Nikolai narrowed his eyes.
I always supported you, your Imperial Highness. All the staff in your house did.
My house? Nikolai smirked.
Speaking of the staff, he said, where are they?
He'd been friends with Renata while he lived here, but not with the rest of the servants, for his status had lain awkwardly in between the staff and the Count and Countess. Besides, the servants had steered well clear of Nikolai, who was often holed up in his room, working on mysterious projects that involved a great deal of banging and cursing and the occasional explosion. They were Galina's lessons to train Nikolai for the game, but the servants knew none of that, and only thought him eccentric and a bit intimidating. Vadim looked off in the direction of the back stairs, which led down to the basement, where the kitchen and laundry and the guts of the house lay.
We were informed by officials of the Countess's death, and were thus dismissed from employment, as there would be no one to pay us. Besides, most of the staff have taken ill from the party the other night. Only Cook, Kostya, the messenger boy, and I remain to take care of the unfinished business. Well, I'm here now,
Nikolai said, choosing not to acknowledge that Vadim was looking wan and wobbling on his feet.
I'd like a proper household. I want you and Kostya to fetch the others. They will have employment under me. Thank you, Your Imperial Highness. It will be a great honor to serve you.
Vadim bowed, a bit unsteadily, then hurried away. Nikolai went up the staircase to the second level and walked along the hallway of portraits of past Zakrevskis. He stopped in front of the mirror at the center of it. It was the first reflection of himself he'd seen since he cast his shroud.
Not too bad, he said.
His hair appeared as he liked it, kept neat and short with minimal sideburns. His jaw was sharp as a knife blade, with cheekbones to match, and his eyes were dark half-moons. Nikolai scowled. The color of his irises was too black, a glimpse of his shadow self piercing through his careful shroud. He glared at the mirror, and the glass disappeared. A second later, a portrait of Galina in an opulent silver gown, formerly hanging in her room so she could admire herself any time she wanted, took the mirror's space. It was a better fit, anyway. This was a hall of Zakrevskis. A reflection of Nikolai had no place there.
Nor do I want one.
He continued into his room, which was still a library as it was the last time he'd been here, but that would not take too long to rectify.
It's my house now. I have free rein to redecorate as I choose.
He nearly smiled, but the darkness within him didn't quite let him. Interior decorating was the sort of thing that would have made the old Nikolai happy, but not the new one. Still, it needed to be done. The first thing that had to go were the draperies. While Nikolai appreciated the quality of the pale rose silk and had nothing against pink itself, he owned several cravats in varying shades of pink, or he had, before Galina had tossed out all his belongings. He just wasn't in the mood for curtains in that color. He snapped his fingers, and black began to bleed down from the tops of the drapes, consuming the more delicate rose until the pink was no more. Next, the shelves. They were full of books on fashion, French, British, Italian, so Nikolai was loath to be rid of them. But the shelves couldn't stay, for there wouldn't be enough space once he had a bed and an armoire in here.
But they could go in Galina's room.
The corner of his mouth turned up smugly.
She made my bedroom into a library as soon as she thought me dead. It would be more than acceptable for me to do the same to hers.
With Vadim and Kostya out running errands, and the cook downstairs in the basement kitchen, Nikolai could use magic without hiding it. He flicked his wrist, and the furniture in Galina's room cleared. With a flick of his other wrist, the shelves and books in his own room migrated down the hall, past the Zakrevsky portraits, marching like awkward soldiers, and settled where Galina's canopy bed used to sit. Nikolai turned back to his own room and exhaled. It was nearly empty now, other than the desk, and that had originally been his, so it could stay. He shifted it a few feet over to where it belonged near the farthest window, but that was the only change. Soon thereafter, he conjured a wooden bed frame stained in black, its posts intricately carved with curlicues and feathers. Atop it lay a fine mattress and fluffy pillows, and a black blanket stitched at the edges in gold. Gold, after all, was the color of the Tsar. Next came an armoire, in carved black wood to match the bed, and gold feather detailing on the handles and hinges. The feet he conjured in gold with talons, like Garuda claws.
"If only it weren't empty," Nikolai thought as he opened the armoire doors.
He could conjure clothes, but conjured clothing was always inferior to what he tailored himself, for nothing could compare to meticulous measuring and remeasuring and cutting the cloth by hand. Well, perhaps not by hand, but his scissors under the direction of his magic were as good as extensions of Nikolai's dexterous fingers. No one had cared what a shadow wore, especially since he tried not to be seen. But his new facade required decent clothing, and in all honesty, decent wouldn't suffice for Nikolai's pride.
"I'll need to acquire several bolts of wool, and needles, and bobbins of thread, and pretty much everything else required to tailor a new wardrobe."
Nikolai frowned at the vast black emptiness of the armoire. He'd send Renata to Bizette and Sons as soon as she arrived back here to work. He could trust her to pick fabrics and buttons that he'd like. Nikolai conjured a pad of paper and pencils, and began to sketch furiously a design for a frock coat he had in mind. It had notched lapels. No, that wouldn't do. He was the Grand Prince, and formality dictated that his lapels be decidedly unnotched. He laughed to himself. Galina would have liked to witness this. She'd always disdained his penchant for notched lapels. He tore out the sheet of paper, crumpled it, and started anew. An hour later, he had a design he was satisfied with. But as Nikolai looked at it, he saw the futility in it. What was the point of a new coat if he had nowhere to wear it to? It was like being a debutante in a gown without an invitation to a ball.
"I need to secure the crown once and for all," Nikolai thought.
Then he'd have plenty of places to be in his fine clothes. Not that that was the reason he wanted to depose Pasha, but it was an amusing one. He laughed under his breath. His head ached, though, and he didn't have any ideas for how to attack Pasha next. What Nikolai wanted was an evening to regroup, and something to eat. He suddenly craved bread and smoked fish, and the dark corners of a tavern.
"The magpie and the fox, then," he thought, pushing back from his desk. "That's exactly what I need."
Chapter 52. An evening storm blasted off Chinan Island with snow, and Vika huddled inside her cottage by the page. She wore her thickest sweater, a scarf, and a hat Ludmila had knit for her years ago. On top of that, she'd wrapped herself in father's favorite blanket, a fraying thing he'd brought back from one of his scientific expeditions to the Kamchatka Peninsula, and it seemed that the memory of Sergei was one of the only things that kept Vika from shivering to death. The storm grew angrier and shook her house. Its bitter wind suddenly found every exposed crevice in the walls and howled its way in. Without thinking, Vika snapped her fingers to seal the cracks near the windows. The bracelet immediately seared her skin.
"Ah!"
Vika crumpled on the floor, clutching her arm while also calling off the enchantment on the house. The cuff stopped burning. But because she could not use magic to heal herself, Vika didn't stop hurting. Tears streamed down her face as pain continued like hot irons on her skin. She curled on the rug, teeth clenched as she tried to bear the lingering heat.
"I'm just an ordinary girl now,"
Vika nearly choked on the thought, and she curled more tightly on the rug, attempting to hold herself together. and the pain wouldn't go away. She hugged her singed arm against her chest and sucked in short breaths through her teeth.
Vika!
Ludmila's sing-song call cut through the storm outside.
I brought you supper, my sunshine.
Her ruddy face, wrapped in a fur-lined hood, peered in through the window.
Oh, my goodness!
The baker shoved open the front door and rushed to Vika on the floor. She tossed aside the parcel she carried and gathered Vika into her bosom.
What happened? Burnt?
Vika forced herself to release her arm from her chest and show Ludmila her wrist. It was covered by the bracelet, but Ludmila would know what she meant. Ludmila cradled her arm.
Did you cool it with water?
Vika shook her head. Cool it with water? Was that what normal people did? The horror of being ordinary slammed into her again, as viciously as the storm pummeled everything outside. She slumped.
Wait here.
Ludmila gently laid Vika on the rug, grabbed a large mixing bowl off the counter, and hurried out the front door. A minute later, she returned with a bowl full of snow, which she set on the floor at Vika's side. She added some water from the pitcher on the kitchen table.
Now give me your wrist.
Ludmila plunged her arm into the bowl. The icy water rushed all around Vika's singed skin. She gasped at the cold. But slowly, the pain gave way to a chilly numbness, and she could breathe more fully again.
Better?
Ludmila asked, as she dabbed at Vika's wrist with a towel.
Yes, thank you. It still hurts, but it's better. It will probably scar.
Vika's unharmed hand went to her collarbone. Ludmila's eyes widened.
Oh, my sunshine, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. It's all right,
Vika said, even though it wasn't. The crossed wands of the game had been when everything not all right had begun.
I'm just glad you came when you did. Me too. I'm also glad I brought you food.
Ludmila got to her feet and picked up the brown paper parcel she'd tossed aside when she first came in. She offered her hand and helped Vika up and to the table.
I thought a fresh Borodinsky loaf and sausages might cheer you up. And it's a good thing I brought Oreshki cookies with me, too. You could certainly use some of those.
Ludmila unwrapped the package and laid supper out before them. Just listening to the warm, musical lilt of Ludmila's voice felt like a breakthrough of sunbeams, however weak. A hint of a smile touched Vika's mouth as she settled in at the table, tenderly resting her burnt wrist on the tablecloth. She picked up one of the walnut-shaped confections, its two halves stuck together with rich caramel, and nibbled at it. The sugar touched her tongue, and then went straight through her veins to her wrist. Or so it seemed. Cookies really were the best medicine.
I can't believe you trekked all the way up here, Vika said.
Ludmila kissed her on the head. Vika melted.
Will you be all right if I leave you? One of my customers' nieces is getting married tomorrow, and I still have to bake all the sweets for the wedding. If you need me, though, I'll be fine, thank you. Now that the worst of the pain is past, I can make a poultice for the burn, using one of Father's herbal compounds. But really, truly, thank you. You're so busy, yet you still traipse through a storm to bring supper.
Ludmila shrugged.
I love you, my sunshine. And that's what happens when you love someone. Sacrifices stop being sacrifices, simply because they make you happy. Caring for you makes me happy, so it's not a sacrifice. It's what I want to do.
Vika set the rest of her cookie on the table and threw her arms around Ludmila. The melting snow on Ludmila's cloak pressed cold and wet against her, but Vika didn't care. All she wanted was to hug this incredible woman, who was not her mother, but was, Vika realized, better. Ludmila had been here Vika's entire childhood, as had Sergei. Perhaps this was why, even after the revelation that Sergei was not her biological father, Vika hadn't felt the need to know or search for her supposedly real parents. Ludmila and Sergei were more real than anyone else could ever be. Vika buried her face against Ludmila's soft chest.
I don't know who I am without magic.
Ludmila stroked the black streak in her hair.
We are not defined by what we can do, but by what we actually do. You're a fierce, smart girl, Vika, and you will find a way to make your mark, even without magic in your veins. I know who you are, and I think whatever happens next will help you see who you are, too.
Vika lingered in Ludmila's embrace, comforted by her caramel-scented warmth. Vika still felt hollow inside, but at least she knew this was home. A moment later, she released Ludmila.
I suppose I ought to let you return to the bakery. Bolshoi spasiba for helping with the burn, and for supper.
Ludmila flicked a finger under Vika's chin.
Hold your head high, my sunshine. Remember, it's not magic that defines you. It's you that defines you. That's all the truth that there is.
Vika watched as Ludmila left and hiked back down the snowy hill. Thankfully, the storm had slowed to a flurry. When she was gone, Vika returned to the kitchen. Her wrist hurt, but not as much anymore. She made a poultice with herbs from various glass jars Father had kept in the cabinet, and wrapped the cool bandage around her forearm and bracelet. Then she sliced the Borodinsky bread Ludmila had brought, heated a sausage, and made tea. Vika sat down near the page, warmed by the fire, and took a bite of her bread, chewing thoughtfully. She might not have been able to use magic, but Ludmila was right. She wasn't powerless either.
I am who I make myself to be.
She finished her bread and sausage and sipped at her tea. Then Vika smiled, picked up an Oreshki cookie, and popped the entire thing in her mouth. It was time to figure out what, exactly, she was going to do, and who she was going to be. Chapter 53. As Nikolai stepped inside the rowdy tavern, he was hit by memories. The magpie and the fox used to be his and Pasha's, where they came when Pasha wanted to sneak out of the palace and be anyone other than Cesarevich, and where Nikolai could put aside the strains of his enchanter training and feel like a normal boy. Nikolai's stomach soured. He almost turned back around to head for the door. But then what had begun as a queasiness in his stomach quickly shifted to a hard knot of anger. Why should Nikolai have to abandon the tavern simply because Pasha had once frequented it? Not everything should default to Pasha for the mere reason that he was heir to the throne. Besides, Nikolai would take the crown from him, somehow, perhaps even more easily now that Vika was forbidden from using magic, and then everything that was once Pasha's could and would become Nikolai's. He just needed to figure out how. He needed a new plan. He also needed something to eat. Nikolai snuck into a dark corner of the tavern. He hadn't cast his facade, for he wanted to move about unseen, a shadow among shadows, and swiped a few slices of rye bread and smoked fish off a wooden platter at a table where the conversation had grown too animated for the patrons to pay attention to their food. He moved deeper into the tavern and lurked around a group of rowdy gamblers who already had 5 empty vodka bottles on their table next to their piles of coins and bills.
You should have seen the look on the girl's face when I cornered her,
one of the men said, his mouth full of half-chewed pickle.
Did she scream with horror when you unbuckled your belt and she saw how tiny your member was?
Another man said, as he drew a card from the deck.
I think you're confusing your own experience with mine.
The first louse of a man spit on the floor.
The only screams were from the girl and her sister, begging me for more.
His fellow gamblers guffawed, and he sneered in victory. A serving girl walked by at that unfortunate moment, and the man smacked her rear end. He was met with more hoots of approval from his drinking mates.
Swine,
Nikolai thought. As a silhouette, his sense of propriety might have waned, but it had not yet disappeared entirely. But the dark energy within him bubbled for another reason. It wanted more of its own kind, even though Nikolai didn't necessarily need it, since Aijana's strength was more than enough. But the energy was greedy, and it craved more darkness. That made these men perfect targets. Nikolai reached out of the shadows to touch the first gambler's back. The energy shuddered through to him, and with it, he felt the magic in his fingertips hum ever stronger, pulsing with shadow. Nikolai almost sighed out loud, for energy was like water. No, vodka, after being parched for too long. He took and took until the man's head bobbed, drowsy from what Nikolai stole. His friends only pointed and laughed.
The great Stanislav of Sonaya Square can't hold his drink anymore.
Nikolai let go.
The great Stanislav of Sonaya Square.
He edged around to get a better look at the man's face. No, not a man, but a boy Nikolai's age. The face was rougher than he remembered, skin leathered from long days in the sun, but it was the same reprobate with whom Nikolai used to play cards. Stanislav was a liar and a swindler and a brute, and that was only a list of his best qualities. Stanislav mumbled something, then slumped onto the table, face in a platter of herring, and began to snore. His friends laughed harder, then emptied his pockets of the rest of his rubles.
Each is worse than the next, Nikolai thought as he watched them. All the better for me.
He decided to take energy from every single one of them. When he was finished, they were all asleep with their faces smashed in the herring. Nikolai scooped up the bills and coins and poured them into the serving girl's apron pocket as she walked by.
For you,
he whispered. It was that tiny bit of propriety, that sliver of sunlight that still existed within him, that made him do it. The servant girl looked all around her, but couldn't find her benefactor. When she dipped her hand into her apron pocket, though, she smiled and said,
Thank you.
Nikolai felt both wonderfully vile and horribly saintly in the moment, and that strange oil and water roiling churned within him again, like it had when he'd absorbed some of Vika's magic in the egg. He frowned and spat on the floor, as if that would rid him of the discomfort of being good. He began to walk away, but then he paused. Stanislav's and the others' shadows were following him. Well, not exactly following, for they weren't alive by any means, but they stretched thin, as the shadows of the girl and her father at the toy shop had done. One end stuck to their owners, the other attracted to Nikolai. He took another step, and then another and another, and the shadows from other patrons began to cling to him too. Nikolai watched as more shadows joined, stretching thinner and then thinner still, until he was on the far side of the tavern. The magpie and the fox was striped with eerie, willowy silhouettes from one end to the other. Nikolai grinned. And then, when the shadows were on the brink of nearly snapping, he waved his hand to release them from his pull. They sprang away. He'd let them go back to whom they belonged. For now. The shadows closest to him returned to a table near the wall, where a boy his age and three men in their mid-30s huddled. Nikolai furrowed his brow as he studied them, for he could tell they weren't the sort who normally met in the Magpie and the Fox. They had attempted to dress below their station, but unbeknownst to them, their mannerisms gave them away. They ignored everyone around them, customers and servers alike, in the manner of the highborn, who were accustomed to not seeing those beneath them. Nikolai simultaneously hated them and wanted to be them.
I have no problem with the Cesarevich, one of the men said. The Cesarevich has a reputation for generosity. It's the Grand Princess I take issue with.
Blazes, that's Major General Sergei Volkonsky.
Nikolai recognized him, of course. Everyone in St. Petersburg knew him. But what was a man like Volkonsky doing in a hole like the magpie and the fox?
It is substantiated fact,
said a man with a pinched face, as he gesticulated with a pickle in his hand,
that the Grand Princess was always at the Tsar's right hand. She attended every meeting of the Imperial Council, whereas the Tsarevich did not.
A third man, this one long-faced, cleared his throat. It was Colonel Sergei Trubetskoy, another prominent member of the nobility whom Nikolai recognized.
The Grand Princess would see a continuation of their father's policies,
Trubetskoy said.
But Russia cannot continue like this. We need a constitution. We need accountability.
Nikolai listened intently from his dark corner. Perhaps he had misjudged these men earlier. Perhaps they ignored all those around them, not because they thought themselves superior, but because they were so engrossed in their patriotism that they saw nothing else. And he was empathetic to their ideals. If anyone understood the inequality of Russian society, it was Nikolai.
We should kill the Grand Princess when we revolt, the pinched-faced man said.
Pavel Ivanovich Pestel,
Trubetskoy whispered urgently.
Keep your voice down. We will not condone murder.
But I would.
The wheels in Nikolai's head began to turn. What were these men up to? And could they be of use to him? Pestel leaned back in his chair.
What we discuss is all treason. It is just the degree of severity that matters.
There must be another way, Trubetskoy said. There is, Volkonsky said. That's why Ilya is here tonight. He has an interesting proposal.
Nikolai squinted in the dim light. Yes, it was Ilya Koshkin, whom he knew because Ilya was the only member of the guard who ever had a clue where to find Pasha when he snuck out. Ilya was also, in a way, like Nikolai. Both were ignored at home. Ilya because he was the fourth son, and Nikolai because he'd never really had parents to begin with. But both boys were still ambitious enough to make something of themselves outside of that. Nikolai shifted a little closer to the table. At the same time, the other men turned their attention to Ilya. Ilya fidgeted in his seat, but then cleared his throat and said,
I suggest that, instead of waiting until next summer to revolt, as we'd originally planned when the Tsar was still alive, we ought to act sooner. The Tsarevich is scrambling to fix the mess that's been made with magic, and I've been working to recruit more soldiers to our side as a result of it. They're afraid of his witch, edict or not.
Trubetskoy sipped on his beer.
This is interesting.
The timing is perfect for a coup, Ilya said. The Tsarevich has not been officially crowned, and there are rumors that the Tsar wasn't his father. Politically speaking, this is optimal for us. We wouldn't be usurping a Tsar. We'd be taking the throne from an illegitimate son.
Volkonsky nodded, a smile on his face like a proud father watching his child come into his own.
But who would we install in the Tsarevich's place?
Trubetskoy asked.
No one,
Pestel said.
We create a democracy.
Trubetskoy frowned.
We've been over this before. Russia isn't ready for that. Look at the disaster that ensued in France when they demolished the monarchy too swiftly.
But the United States,
Pestel began,
is much different from Russia, Volkonsky said. They are a very young country. We are much more like France than America.
Trubetskoy nodded.
We must take the long view and shift first to something in between, hence my preference for a constitutional monarchy. I know you disagree, Pestel. You always have. But the majority of us believe this is the right course for the country.
Fine, then.
Pestel crossed his arms.
Who would you propose to lead your so-called constitutional monarchy?
I could do it,
Nikolai thought, and he began to smile. In fact, this was precisely what he needed. A path to the crown with political legitimacy. It would also be easier for the Russian people to accept him as Tsar if he didn't murder Pasha outright. Better if he let a bunch of revolutionaries do it for him. As a bonus, they would be making a better Russia. Yes, a better empire for those like Nikolai, who were not born privileged or free. He was so gleeful at having a new plan, he almost laughed out loud. Nikolai cast a shroud to make himself appear more himself, then pulled up a chair and inserted himself at the table between Pestel and Trubetskoy. The men startled and jerked away.
"I suggest you install me on the throne," Nikolai said.
"Grand Prince Karimov,"
Ilya whispered, gawking. He pushed back from his seat and began to rise so he could bow. Nikolai smiled but put his index finger to his mouth.
"Let's keep my identity among the five of us for tonight, shall we? Otherwise, how will we surprise the Cesarevich if it's public knowledge that I've joined you?"
Ilya nodded ferociously and sat back down. But as a precaution, Nikolai conjured a shield around them to muffle their conversation.
"How do we know it's you and not some magical trickery ordered by the Cesarevich?"
Trubetskoy asked, carefully treading the sword-thin line between skepticism and respect, in case Nikolai really was Nikolai.
"You don't, but believe Ilya when he tells you who I am. In fact, you and I were acquainted in society before my paternity was known. I was Countess Zakrevskaya's ward. You may ask me anything you like to verify my identity. Once you have been satisfied, I should like to speak with you about helping with your plans, and you with mine."
"Plans?"
Trubetskoy cast his gaze about the tavern.
"We have no plans."
"Very well, then. You have no plans."
Let Trubetskoy be cautious. Nikolai would have done the same were he in the other man's shoes, for the previous conversation alone was enough grounds for a conviction of treason. Ilya grinned at Nikolai. Pestel appraised him. Bolkonsky watched him a bit more cautiously, but hopefully. Trubetskoy, however, narrowed his eyes and shifted in his seat subtly. He hadn't become a celebrated war hero by being foolish. Nikolai would have to volunteer information to gain his trust.
"The first time we met face to face, Colonel, was at a ball, 2 years ago, at Count Rostov's home. You gave a toast that night, to commemorate the new ballroom in which we danced."
"Anyone could know these facts."
"All right. Then how about this? You know I used to sharpen swords for a lieutenant in your regiment in exchange for lessons. In May of last year, you declared that the very knife you're fingering in your belt now was destroyed. But your lieutenant told you I could fix it. He brought it to me at our next lesson. The blade snapped an inch from the hilt. I don't know what you did to the knife for it to buckle like that. What remained attached to the hilt had been bent 40-some degrees. But I did fix it."
Trubetskoy didn't put his hand on the table where Nikolai could see it. He kept it right where it was, on his belt, close and yet no nearer to his knife.
"How do you know this?" "I told you. I'm the one who fixed it. My initials are stamped onto the base of the blade. You can check it. In fact, I insist you do."
Now Trubetskoy unsheathed the dagger and turned it in the light of the single lamp on the table. He focused on the metal near the hilt. Nikolai knew what he'd see. The letters NK engraved in Nikolai's own handwriting, for he hadn't needed a blacksmith's stamp. He'd used his magic to etch his mark into the blade. Trubetskoy examined the knife for several more seconds before he tucked it away. Then he dipped his head in respect. A smile of relief broke across Ilya's face. Pestel leaned closer to Nikolai.
"If I may ask, what's happened to you? Is it true your brother tried to kill you, but you survived?" "Well, more accurately, the Grand Princess," Nikolai said. "Yuliana, as you know, can be rather ruthless, but Pasha was complicit."
"Her influence over him is even worse than we feared," Pestel said to the other men.
At this, The energy inside Nikolai began to burble again.
"We can rectify the situation," he said. "I like the ideas you and the others put forth.
You would support us in the reforms. You would abolish serfdom and be willing to entertain a constitutional monarchy."
Nikolai's smile was laced with the ugliness of retribution.
"If you would support me on the throne, I would support your reforms."
All four men dropped their heads, bowing without standing or making a show of it. Finally, Trubetskoy spoke.
"This is more than we could have hoped for. My men and I are behind you. Whatever you need is yours,"
Volkonsky added.
"Excellent," Nikolai said. "Then let's discuss how we achieve our goals. Ilya mentioned staging a coup soon. I suggest we do it by blocking Pasha's coronation."
"That's only a few weeks away," Ilya said.
"Can you have your soldiers ready?"
Trubetskoy cleared his throat.
"We are one of the greatest armies in all of Europe. It won't be a problem to mobilize."
"The coronation will take place in Moscow," Nikolai said. "Ilya, you're privy to the Cesarevich's conversations. Has he discussed the route they intend to take?"
Ilya shook his head.
"Not when I've been there. But perhaps they'd been counting on the Imperial Enchanter to evanesce them and whatever they needed to Moscow."
"Ever since?"
Trubetskoy stumbled on the unfamiliar word.
"That's how she magically appears and disappears, isn't it?"
Ilya asked. Nikolai cocked a brow.
I was there at Peter Square when you argued with the Cesarevich," Ilya said. "I saw her appear out of thin air, then and another time."
"Huh." Nikolai had thought that he, Pasha, and Vika were alone that night he animated the statue of Peter the Great. Apparently, Ilya was even better at sneaking around and tracking Pasha than he was given credit for. But Nikolai didn't want the others to know he was an enchanter. He didn't know how they'd react, especially since Trubetskoy had been wary of magical trickery when Nikolai first pulled up to their table. Nikolai pursed his lips and subtly shook his head as he looked at Ilya. Ilya blinked, then nodded, once. He bit back the smile forming on his lips. Nikolai would have to take that as a sign of comprehension.
"The Imperial Enchanter is forbidden to use magic now,"
he said to Trubetskoy, Volkonsky, and Pestel.
"That means Pasha will be forced to travel by carriage. He'll be exposed."
Pestel scooted closer to the table.
"They'll use the main road. The alternate routes are nearly impassable in winter." "It's good that we know where they'll be," Volkonsky said. "Easier to know where to ambush them. But bad that the weather will be punishing, even on the main road,"
Trubetskoy said, tapping his vodka glass.
"It will make things difficult for us, too."
"Still," Nikolai said, "I like this idea."
He didn't say that they wouldn't be entirely on their own, that he had magic to assist them.
"Can you work on the details of the battle plan and present it to me soon?"
The four men bowed their heads again.
"Of course, Your Imperial Highness."
"Excellent."
Nikolai poured 5 shots of vodka. Ilya raised a glass.
"To Karimov and the Constitution," he said quietly.
"To Karimov and the Constitution,"
Trubetskoy, Volkonsky, and Pestel said. Nikolai smiled as Aijana's black energy simmered inside him.
"I like that."
He raised his own glass.
"To me and the Constitution."
Chapter 54 Vika looked over the granite embankment into a Katarinsky canal in the morning light. During the game, she had enchanted all of St. Petersburg's waterways to shift in color, from ruby red to fire opal orange, then golden citrine, emerald green, sapphire blue, amethyst, then back to red to start the rainbow again. And as winter had set in, the canals and rivers had frozen in whatever color they'd happened to be in. The Ekaterinsky Canal, in particular, had iced over in an unflattering hue between yellow and green. But that wasn't the only thing Vika noticed. A while ago, Nikolai had changed all the posts into gargoyles, each more monstrous than the next, and their vacant stone eyeballs seemed to shift in their sockets as people passed. Nowadays, the citizens crowded into the center of the streets and alleys to get away from the embankments. Some took longer routes in an attempt to avoid walking along the waterways in general. And instead of festive Christmas tinsel tied to the posts, some braver souls had fastened small bundles of sticks, leaves, and sprigs of winter berries. Poisonous berries. Wards against witchcraft. Vika's resolve to do something, rather than wallow in self-pity at home, strengthened. Declaring that magic would no longer be used clearly hadn't improved much, other than some people had begun to come out from hiding in their houses. A different tactic was needed. Vika just didn't quite know what. When she reached the Zakrevsky house, or was it the Karimov house now, she hesitated in front of the steps. The last time she was here, she'd sent in Poslanik's army to destroy all of Galina's and Nikolai's belongings. She'd left their home in ruins, broken chandeliers, shredded Persian rugs, and most of Nikolai's wardrobe eaten through by the moths. Then Vika had run away in cowardly remorse. She winced. There were so many things wrong with that move. It had been an enormous, multifaceted mistake.
"But I'm not that girl anymore,"
Vika thought as she forced herself up the steps. She still didn't know who exactly she intended to be, but it wasn't that version of herself. She also knew without a doubt that how she defined herself would involve how she dealt with Nikolai. Even without access to magic, even with her heart wary, she could still feel the string that connected them. The question was whether she was supposed to destroy him, save him, or rule the Empire by his side. This was what Vika hoped to answer if she could see him. Regardless of the outcome, though, she wouldn't be subordinate to anyone. Not Nikolai, not Pasha. It didn't matter that she didn't have use of magic right now, or that she was bound by a bracelet.
"I am Vika Andreeva, and I am as important as anybody else."
Vika rang the bell and studied the carvings of roses on the door while she waited for an answer. A minute later, a footman opened the door.
"Bonjour, mademoiselle," he said.
"Bonjour. I'm here to see Nikolai."
The footman clucked his tongue at her.
"His Imperial Highness is not accepting visitors."
"Oh, are we doing that now? Using formal titles?"
Vika bristled.
"Then tell His Imperial Highness that the Baroness Victoria Sergeyevna Andreeva is here to see him."
The footman blanched.
"You're the witch. You're the one who made us all sick from the fate."
"I did no such..."
The footman shut the door in her face. Vika tried to charm the door to unlock, but her bracelet singed her immediately, and she cried out and crumpled on the front steps. She clutched her wrist and pressed it onto the ice on the step, in an attempt to cool it faster. The pain would subside soon, for it was only a brief burn like touching a hot pan, but she sucked air through her teeth while the hurt faded.
"Damn you, Yuliana, and Pasha too!"
Vika was chained to the tsardom, but they'd forbidden her from using the very magic that provided the basis for why she was chained in the first place. Like this, Vika wasn't a dragon on a leash. They'd rendered her a mere lizard. And yet, she knew she had been the one who'd taken the vow to the crown. She had been the one who wanted to be Imperial Enchanter. Under no circumstances would she have given up her ability to use magic, even knowing that the power came at a steep price. Vika would just have to create her own destiny with what she had. She knocked on the door again. It opened and the footman reappeared.
"You're still here?"
"Yes, and I'm not going away until I can see His Imperial Highness."
The footman frowned, but said,
"At least I don't have to chase you down to deliver this. His Imperial Highness, in all his magnanimity, has a message for you."
He clearly disapproved of Nikolai's supposed magnanimity, though, for the footman hurled a note card at Vika. It ricocheted off her coat and into the snow. Then he slammed the door again. Unbelievable. Still, Vika fumbled for the note in the snow.
I cannot be seen associating with you. I am sure you understand why. But it doesn't mean we cannot meet where circumstances are not quite so real. Close your eyes, feel the magic, and find me there. N.
Chapter 55. Vika tried to shut off her brain and feel the magic, as Nikolai had instructed. She used to do that more often when she was younger, but ever since the game began, she'd found herself thinking more and feeling less. She closed her eyes. She didn't need to enchant anything to sense the presence of magic that already existed. Even normal people, if they were aware enough, would be able to identify what was ordinary and what was extraordinary. They just hadn't had the practice to know the difference. The invisible string that connected Vika to Nikolai twitched. She let her feet follow, and she tripped a little down the steps, along the canal, through the streets toward the bay. Toward Letney Isle. Of course. Nikolai's benches were there, and where else were circumstances less real than there, where dreams constituted a reality in which a shadow boy had lived? Despite everything that had happened, Letney Isle was the place that still tethered them together. Or it could be a trap. Vika stood on the banks of the Nivar a moment more. It would be wiser not to go. But sometimes, destiny pulls so taut, one follows no matter what the consequences might be. Besides, caution was not part of Vika's vocabulary. Well, perhaps a tiny bit of caution would be smart, given that she didn't have use of magic right now. She rang the bell again. The footman opened the door and didn't even bother to speak this time. He simply arched a brow.
"Could I borrow a quill and ink?" Vika asked. "If you have a response for His Imperial Highness, I can simply relay it to him." "No, I'd rather write it down."
The footman sighed, closed the door in her face, again, and returned a minute later with a quill and an inkpot. Vika flipped over the note card Nikolai had sent her, and, holding it on her lap, composed a quick message on its blank side.
"Pasha, I've gone to Letney Isle to meet Nikolai. It's possible it's a trap, although I hope not. However, if you do not hear from me by sunset, please reinstate my ability to use magic so that I can free myself. V."
The footman tapped his boot. Vika rose and pushed the quill and inkpot back into his hands.
"Thank you."
She turned and descended the front steps.
"What about the note for His Imperial Highness?"
the footman asked. Vika turned back and winked.
"Oh, it's for a different Imperial Highness."
The footman puffed out his chest and grumbled. Vika smirked as she hurried off, stopping at the Winter Palace to leave the note for Pasha with a guard. The palace was on the way to the ferry. Then made her way toward the singular place that existed only because of her and Nikolai. She closed her eyes when she arrived. She didn't need to see what they'd created. Vika knew the layout of the island because she'd invented every tree and rock, every path and every dead end. She knew the lanterns Nikolai had charmed to drift above the leaves and branches, and she knew his dream benches. But what she didn't know was where their magic truly intersected, and how. The tugging in her chest guided her. It was still faint, so she lost the pull as she wandered through the maple grove, overwhelmed by the remnants of her own magic and the sugar-sweet scent of syrup in the air. Vika almost opened her eyes, but she stopped herself. She concentrated harder instead.
"Remember Nikolai," she thought. "Remember his warmth and elegance, not the cruel magic from the doll's fate and the carriage of swords, but when his magic was like silk dancing in the wind."
The breeze quickened around Vika. Her breath did too. And with it came what felt like a wisp of silk that curled around her body before it spun away again. But it was enough. She chased its wake, and, although she lost the feel of the silk, she heard